So, yeah, thanks for the invitation to speak here today. It's great to be visiting Perimeter again, and nice to have a strings conference here. Even this works. Amazing. Wow. That's incredible. It didn't even, like, touch the device, and it works. It's very impressive. Okay. Beautiful. Yeah, so I'm going to tell you about some work that's going to appear very soon, probably within the week, with Alex Bellin, Jan de Boer, Pranjal Nayak, and Julian Sonner. And the idea is to describe some ensembles of approximate CFTs, which look like ensembles over the CFT data. So it will look be some kind of matrix and tensor model. The tensor is from the structure constants, which in an appropriate limit would impose all of the constraints of CFTs. But one can study this model sort of order by order, and at, you know, individual pieces haven't yet imposed all CFT constraints exactly, but those pieces end up looking like 3D gravity. So that's kind of a summary in one sentence. But it involves a bunch of different pieces. So first I'll give a kind of introduction, and then introduce this notion of approximate CFTs, and then I'll describe this particular ensemble of approximate CFTs, and describe its relation to 3D gravity, and then conclude. So, I mean, in general, the features of high-energy microstates and quantum chaotic systems have a pseudo-random aspect. They're not truly random in the sense that in a specific system, they are specific numbers, but if we're in the dense part of the spectrum, where there's some thermal entropy, the number of microstates is e to the s, and each one is some infinite precision number, but those numbers are effectively random. Okay, and one can encode their statistical properties in an ensemble. So this is kind of trading an ensemble over choice of exactly which microstate are we discussing within a microcanonical band with something that looks more like an ensemble of theories. Okay, so now this is, of course, a very old idea, going back to Wigner, right, to treat a complicated Hamiltonian of some heavy nuclei as effectively a random matrix. And so in this context, the idea is that typical element of the ensemble, meaning a specific theory out of this ensemble of more general theories, have the same effective observables as the original system. So sort of from the point of view of a long-distance phenomenon, it looks the same, but individual elements of this ensemble will have the exact microstate energies shifted around by a little bit, for example. Now, in quantum mechanics, these give random matrix models, like the old example of Wigner. So we might have the Hamiltonian, which has matrix elements ij in some basis of the Hilbert space. And if we have other simple operators, they also give us matrices. So this sort of fits into some story of matrix models. If we have CFTs or QFTs, then there's another piece of data, which is a three-point function, including three-point functions of the high-dimension operators, which are like, we have here light operators, we're evaluating their matrix elements between high-energy states, which are in some thermal region of the spectrum, but in a CFT, we can also have the fusion of three high-energy states with each other. So that gives a new ingredient, which will look like a tensor. Now, sometimes these matrix ensembles, these ensembles characterizing pseudo-random property of chaotic system, has some surprising or fascinating connection to gravity. So we might say that the SSS matrix model for JT gravity basically reinterpreted the old story from the early 90s of the connection between minimal string theory and matrix models as a Wigner-type matrix ensemble for the holographically dual Hamiltonian. So in particular limit of the 2D minimal gravity, which people at that time were thinking of as being on the world sheet of a string, but we can think of it just as some 2D gravity theory. Some limit of it looks like JT gravity. And you might ask, what's the holographic dual of JT gravity? It's some quantum mechanical system described by Hamiltonian H. But if we sum over all the topologies Then there will be connected contributions. So some quantity like this, product of multi-traces, will look like a thing which has asymptotic boundaries with, you know, inverse temperature beta 1, beta 2, et cetera. And connected contributions look non-factorized, right? And we can sum over 2D topologies, and those are related to evaluating this thing in the SSS ensemble. Now, from the point of view of 2D holography, the lack of factorizability might seem to be a kind of puzzle, in the sense that if we, you know, think about n equals 4 super Young Mills or other higher D examples of holography, we have a specific theory which is dual to ADS. There's nothing being averaged, and if I take, you know, product of partition functions on separate manifolds, the answer is the product. There's no connected contribution if we're studying n equals 4 super Young Mills. So that might seem perhaps puzzling. And so it's especially interesting to understand how, you know, what of this story extends to higher dimensions. And, you know, a lot of people have started to think about that, especially in 3D, which might be the first step up. And even Lorenz's talk in the morning is somewhat related. Now, again, the microdata of CFTs, just to make sure it's clear, I'll say it again, you know, it consists of the dilatation operator acting on the Hilbert space, which is graded by spin, or equivalently, we could characterize it by left and right moving weight, if we're in 2D, and the structure constant. So that gives a matrix and a tensor. And again, if I have an arbitrary CFT, then, you know, some of the operators will be in a sparse part of the spectrum. Those are not very well characterized by a pseudo-random ensemble. But then the, you know, high energy part or high dimension part of the spectrum, where the level spacing becomes very fine, are well described by an pseudo-random ensemble, especially if we're talking about a chaotic CFT or a CFT which has a holographic dual. And for simplicity today, I'll mostly think about, have in mind a large C 2D CFT which has no operators below the black hole threshold other than the identity and its descendants. So in other words, just the multi-products of the stress energy tensor and no other light operators. If there were other light operators, you'll get more matrices because I'll have, you know, the matrix elements of the light operator between heavy states, and I'll have to say, you know, what the light data is and so on. But we'll consider sort of the case without light operators just for simplicity. Now, a part of this story that was sort of eventually came to fruition in this paper, we could say at sort of at first pass, you know, there's, of course, the Cardy formula tells us the asymptotics of the spectral density, which comes from, you know, the modular transform of the T2 partition function of the identity, but we can interpret it in the context of 3D gravity as telling us about the BTZ black hole contribution to the entropy or the spectral density. And similarly, if you look at the structure constants by studying their compatibility with the, you know, identity operator exchange in the, you know, in sort of the S channel, then you can conclude that for the T channel contribution to match at large values of the dimension, they must asymptotically approach some particular value, which turns out to equal Liouville three-point function, basically. And interestingly, as was shown in this paper, if you write an associated Gaussian ensemble associated to this quadratic moment of the structure constants, it reproduces certain contributions to pure 3D gravity. So contributions look like certain kind of handlebodies or Euclidean wormholes. But an important point is that once we're in higher dimensions, meaning CFT2 or higher, there are constraints, right? In quantum mechanics, in principle, any Hamiltonian is allowed, right? We can define an arbitrary matrix, you know, Hermitian matrix acting on a Hilbert space and say that's the Hamiltonian. But in CFTs, there are the constraints of locality, right? And that's really what four-point crossing encodes. It's four-point crossing implies that the operator commutators vanish outside the light cone. So we can, if we have a set of CFT data that does not obey the bootstrap constraint, everything looks like it transforms correctly under conformal symmetry. The thing that will not work is that the commutator of operators outside the light cone will not be zero. Okay? And in 2D, there's an additional constraint which comes from modular invariance on the torus, and the kind of most general possibility is to look at the one-point function of an operator on a torus and its modular invariance. And it turns out that four-point crossing and torus modular invariance of one-point functions are the full set of constraints. So all higher point or higher genus analogs follow from those by Moore and Seiberg's old results. But these constraints are very strong. So once we're no longer in the world of quantum mechanics dual to 2D gravity, we don't expect there to exist ensembles over exact CFT data, you know, with e to the s parameters, where I can just monkey around with individual microstates in the heavy part of the spectrum. It will break the consistency conditions. Higher D CFTs are sparse in a way very different than quantum mechanical Hamiltonians, for which there aren't any consistency constraints. So we would expect that disordered exact duals are not possible in higher D gravity. Okay. So how do we kind of reconcile these two seemingly very different pictures? And that's, in a way, part of the goal of the talk today. So at first, I'll define a notion of an approximate CFT, which is going to be a structure that, you know, looks like CFT data, but it only approximately satisfies the crossing constraints. Those will permit ensembles. But then I'll discuss a specific ensemble which, you know, limit would localize to a true CFT in the sense that it has a parameter of the ensemble which is imposing the consistency constraints of CFTs more and more strongly if I take this limit, and so it allows one to interpolate between these notions. Now, you know, as I said, I'm going to think about a putative CFT2, which is basically a dual of pure 3D gravity, but, you know, we don't even know, actually, I personally kind of doubt that it exists, such a CFT, meaning a CFT with a gap in the spectrum all the way up to the black hole threshold at large C, but there certainly won't exist such a CFT at every value of the central charge, like every real number, right? Even if there were sporadic CFTs of this type, but maybe there don't exist any at all. That's kind of the swampland question, right? What gravity-effective theories have consistent UV completions? And of course, in ADS, we kind of know how to turn it into a math problem because it's just the question of classifying CFTs whose light operators behave as a given effective theory's correlation functions in ADS. Is there any exact CFT like that? Now, you know, maybe disappointingly, but in any case, if we look at correlators around the ADS vacuum, then perturbative solutions to the bootstrap always exist for any effective theory in ADS. That's kind of the claim of this HPPS paper. And in fact, if you work a lot harder, including the input from dispersion relations, there are, you know, some inequalities that must be obeyed on the coefficients of irrelevant operators in your gravity effective theory. But still, you never eliminate, you know, you don't find a sparse collection of possibilities. You still find large islands in the space of effective field theories. And in fact, in a sense, most effective theories allowed by naturalness or infrared consistency seem to be still allowed. Okay? Then we could try to ask about the thermal correlators. So you could look at the correlation functions in the black hole background instead of in empty ADS. That's a different set of data coming from this gravity EFT. And you can ask, well, are there constraints there? And in that case, of course, it involves these matrix aspect, because we have the matrix elements of light operators that are in their correlators between the heavy states, which are the black hole microstates. And so in this case, you find not just that any EFT looks consistent, but that you get consistent ensemble for any EFT. So that's not surprising, because there are e to the s amount of data to say all of the exact matrix elements, and the EFT has some very small amount of data. But it was statistically constrains what the microdata is, but consistency of the microdata doesn't seem to constrain the EFT. Okay, probably, again, there might be some inequalities and so on that hasn't been studied in this context. Here we got something that we call the ETH matrix model, because it's also the subject of this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which is exactly about these random matrix elements. But it must be that there are major constraints from the mutual locality of the black hole microstate operators amongst themselves. And that's something that's very hard to study from the gravity side, because we cannot easily prepare, you know, individual energy eigenstates in a gravity approximation and check whether they obey, you know, microlocality. So this is like the microlocality of the operators that create black holes. But that's the rest of the constraints that have not been imposed to date, and those are going to enter the story here. Okay, so now onto the main point. So we wanted to define this notion of approximate CFT. So that means a collection of the full CFT data, but you only demand that crossing is obeyed up to some tolerance. So you allow a small violation. We could think of it as some exponentially small violation of crossing. And it's most natural to formulate it as that the data that you constrain are the ones available to a low energy observer, which would mean something which has a bound on the total number of operators you insert. You know, if we're in a large engaged theory, it shouldn't be more than n or some power of n or something like that. On the dimension of the external operators, so you imagine we only look at correlators of light enough operators, not maybe the black hole microstates. In 2D, we might constrain the genus. You know, maybe you don't want to consider the genus to be scaling with the central charge. And we will not demand crossing to be obeyed exactly in some regimes of extreme Lorentzian kinematics, like in particular associated to the Reggi regimes, because those are regimes that can kind of pick out contributions of individual operators. And if we say an approximate CFT is a thing that obeys crossing up to this tolerance under those conditions, that does allow e to the s deformations. So now you can shift around some of the exact microstates. You have to do it in a slightly coordinated way, but there are ways that you can move them around. So these things live in ensembles. Now, the way I phrased it there, it was looked like we didn't constrain at all the crossing of the heavy operators, but actually requiring what I just said implies the same approximate crossing for almost all operators, including the heavy ones. Basically, by performing appropriate inversion transformations on higher genus or higher than four-point functions to pick out contributions from, you know, some narrow band of heavy operators that would have been in a channel of a higher point function, and then the higher point or higher genus consistency then demands four-point or torus modular invariance or something for the also external heavy operators. But there might be, you know, an exponentially small number of heavy operators that violate crossing more that wouldn't show up. So, okay. And then again, as I said, it follows from Moore-Seiberg that this is equivalent to just four-point and torus one-point modular invariance. Okay, and if we had light operators other than the identity, you could take them to be fixed or approximately fixed, and that will define slightly different kind of ensembles. Now, the first main point is that although the expectation value of crossing vanishes in the Gaussian ensemble, individual instantiations strongly violate it. So the Gaussian ensemble is not an ensemble of approximate CFTs in this sense. And that can be characterized by computing the variance. You might look at the variance at genus 2 and extract from it by, you know, transforming along these two external lines the variance of just the four-point function of four external, say, heavy operators. And if we're in the Gaussian ensemble, this kind of cross term is just zero, because there's nothing in the Gaussian ensemble that will connect these kind of tensors to those kind of tensors. And so the variance is very big. And in an ensemble of approximate CFTs, this variance should be very tiny. That's kind of the meaning of an ensemble of approximate CFTs. So to fix that, one needs a large quartic moment. You need to have this term cancel those. And that can be achieved by having a large non-Gaussianity, so that some quartic moment of this tensors involves the 6J symbol of the Virasoro algebra. And the 6J symbol appearing there is not a big surprise, because it's closely related by this formula to this Poznat-Teschner crossing kernel, which is exactly the thing which turns a T-channel block into an S-channel block. And that's what you need to kind of relate one of these to the other and cancel these two terms. So the bottom line is that some quartic moment is required to make the variance of crossing small in an ensemble of approximate CFTs. Now, instead of specifying moments, we can write an explicit ensemble. So here, it's convenient to put it in a form where we have an L0 and L0 bar. Those are the left and right moving weights. Those have to be commuting matrices. And then C is the tensor. And maybe I should have mentioned this. Well, I'll say it here. So the kind of the maximum ignorance ensemble consistent with the constraints has a very simple logic. We just take the sum of the squares of the constraints as the potential. So if I have a potential here, which is squares of the crossing constraints, in the limit that the coefficient a goes to infinity, I will have imposed crossing. And so for large a, it's exactly an ensemble of approximate CFTs. And it turns out to be convenient to write the crossing constraint in this sort of local form, where it's like we picked out the contribution of a narrow band of operators in the S channel, and then the function in the T channel is this crossing kernel. So you take the square of those and add it as a constraint, and that ends up giving a potential of this type. And now it looks like a nice potential for a tensor model. It has one structure here where the tensors are contracted in a tetrahedral form, coming with a 6J symbol, and one in this pillow contraction with some smeared delta function. And the smearing is, again, because we have this notion of approximate CFT. Limit the smearing width will go to zero. And then there's a propagator which comes out automatically from the special case where one of these is the identity operator, and that looks like exactly this C0 function that was discussed in the Gaussian model before. And this model is supposed to, this tensor model is supposed to come in this double-scaled limit where the number of operators or the rank of the matrix and the tensor is taken to infinity at the same time as taking this coefficient A to infinity. That's sort of like a usual Tuft double scaling. But also the potential had these delta functions, and their width has to be taken to zero at the same time. So it's a kind of triple scaled limit, if you like. But the fact that this tensor model came from a sum of the potential as a square of constraints has an interesting implication, which is that in principle, in the strict limit, exact crossing is imposed. And then either you localize to a specific CFT or find no solutions. And so that's very different than what happens in something like the SSS matrix model, where even non-perturbatively, there is really an ensemble. Okay, so but what's interesting is to study this theory, meaning the tensor model, in the sort of Tuft and triple line tensor Feynman diagram expansion. And if you do that, the expansion parameters sort of e to the minus c or e to the minus numbers times c, where c is the central charge. So at large c, there's a nice expansion, analogous to the double-scaled expansion in double-scaled matrix models. But then the ultimate fate of the strict limit is the kind of what people in the context of the SSS matrix model called a doubly non-perturbative question about the sum over all the three manifold topologies. So one of the lessons is that the CFT imposing crossing exactly is the thing which generates the sum over all of the complicated hyperbolic three manifolds that are not usually, that people have not summed or haven't summed all of them, at least. So there it looks probably, presumably very different than SSS. Another piece of this potential comes from the square of modular one-point functions, so modular invariance for one-point functions. But the logic is similar, but there one gets an additional quadratic term, and then just the square of modular invariance with no insertions is a pure matrix part. It doesn't involve the structure constants, only the dimensions. And that gives some kind of potential for the dimension delta, which involves single trace and double trace terms. And the diagrammatics of this model turn out to have a very close relation to pure 3D gravity. So to the point where it's kind of natural to conjecture that in this case where there are no fixed primers, no light operators, then term by term in an e to the minus c expansion, the result of the tensor model is exactly what you get from specific three manifolds in pure 3D gravity. And kind of the building block is from this quartic vertex, which is, you know, three structure constants with some exchange of the operators. And it looks exactly the same as this four boundary wormhole studied by this recent paper using the methods of Virasoro TQFT. But there's a difference, and I'll finish up in just a second. A difference here is that the bare propagator of the tensor model has this overall factor of 1 over the big coefficient. So in the limit, the bare propagator goes to 0. To get the answers that agree with 3D gravity, you have to resum an infinite number of tensor model diagrams. And that can actually be done by sort of checking the Schwinger-Dyson equation. So if you sort of think you know what the resummed propagator in four-point vertex is, you can see whether it obeys a set of Schwinger-Dyson equations. And at least for the two-point function, at least for this one, it works. We didn't check all of the higher ones. And so it also has a flavor that's similar to the 3D simplicial gravity of Reggie and Bulatov, where they imagine making simplicial decomposition of three manifold and you sum over them, because it's also the case here that there's a really an infinite sum of diagrams giving a specific three manifold. But curiously, because of the specific potential, and when you take this limit, there's a kind of integrability because we have things like 6J symbols. So all of the diagrams contributing to the same topology seem to be proportional as functions of the weights and so on. So it's just this, the sum over the infinite number of diagrams just kind of correcting this coefficient. And so in that sense, it's also like, you know, this Virasoro TQFT where there's a one diagram looks like the answer on one manifold rather than sum over diagrams equals one manifold, because many diagrams all give the same answer. Of course, some diagrams associated with different topologies give a different answer. Since I'm out of time, maybe I'll just skip these two slides, which I wasn't able to add before anyway. And so the main point is that we define some notion of approximate CFT, and the ensembles of them are strongly non-Gaussian. And at the end of the day, we get some kind of matrix tensor model that's just completely fixed by conformal symmetries and CFT consistency. It's the maximum ignorance ensemble of CFT data consistent with crossing constraints. But its expansion looks just like 3D gravity. And it kind of connects to both the simplicial gravity and Virasoro TQFT. And that's the end of the story. Thanks.
Thank you. So, any questions?
So, earlier on in your talk, you said that it's impossible to define an ensemble of exact conformal field theories. I think that's false, right? Because, it's generically a sparse set,
right?
Just because it's a discrete set doesn't mean you can't define an ensemble. And there's even a sort of natural guess for what the ensemble is that would be dual to pure gravity. Namely, the maximum entropy probability distribution over a space of solutions to the conformal bootstrap, which for a discrete set, you would guess is each one is just weighted by one over the automorphism group of the CFT. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I
should have been more precise. I mean, by an ensemble, I meant an ensemble with e to the s parameters, a matrix or tensor-like ensemble.
Right.
Rather than an ensemble with a much smaller number of
variables. Why would you demand such a large number of free parameters?
Oh no, I don't know. I just meant it won't look like a matrix or a tensor model.
In other words, the statistics would be wrong.
What do you mean?
I mean, I would say we don't really know. We certainly don't know whether there exists, you know, multiple exact CFTs which have identical light data, by which I mean, say, the central charges are exactly the same.
I mean, they're special examples.
I don't think we know any examples where all the data below, by light, I mean below the black hole threshold. So we don't know examples where the data below the black hole threshold is the same, but the data above the black hole threshold is different. Do you know an example like that?
I mean, of course, they're related by modular invariance. So, I mean, it's very difficult to...
The statistics are related by modular. So, in other words, we don't really know many example. I don't think we know any example where we have a kind of specific ensemble fixed by, you know, applying modular invariance to the light data. But then we actually have multiple entries in that ensemble, which are all exact CFTs. But maybe there's some example like that's possible.
So for example, at C equals 24, there are two CFTs that equal all data up to genus 5 and then start differing at greater than genus 5. I mean, there's things like that.
Okay, yeah.
All right, so maybe we can ask.
Hi, Daniel. This is Shuhan.
Hi.
Hi. So there are other ways to quantify how approximate a quantum system is close to a CFT. So for instance, there was a recent proposal by Ling and John McGreevy on how to quantitatively measure how a quantum system is close to a CFT by certain expectation value of the entanglement Hamiltonian. So I was wondering, if that can give another quantitative measure on how approximate your system is close to a CFT.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm not actually familiar with that work, so I can't necessarily, this comment might be off base than what I say, in other words, but the thing that's approximate here is locality, not conformal invariance. So conformal invariance is kind of baked in because these are, you know, defined by characterizing CFT data, but because crossing is not obeyed exactly, the theory is not really local. I'm guessing that in their context, it was conformal invariance that was approximate and locality that was exact. But since I'm not familiar with the paper, I don't know.
They didn't say that very explicitly, but I understand your comment.
What?
All right, thank you.
Okay.
All right. So maybe there is one more.
Yeah. A couple slides ago, you had a tensor model
it's a simple question. You had a tensor model and you were taking a scaling limit, and then you said you wanted to impose crossing. Crossing is imposed exactly, and one either finds this exact CFT or nothing. Presumably you generically expect that almost all the time you get nothing, right?
That's what I would imagine, but...
Now, why aren't we bothered that? It sounds like you're studying nothing.
Well, because sometimes you do get something, right? I mean, in other words...
But you have no sense how often.
Well, I think probably if you wanted to actually use this to say something about some specific exact CFT, I would think you probably want to allow the light data to vary a little bit. So that way, when things localize, you will find, there will be something in the kind of island that you started in. If you take the light data to be exactly fixed, you have to guess it exactly right at the beginning, otherwise you find nothing. As I said, we don't know whether pure 3D gravity is sort of in the swampland, right? So it might be that if we demand that there are no operators, that there's a gap basically up to the black hole threshold, that there are no solutions then at all. I don't know the answer, but I think that studying this kind of model, this kind of tensor model, might be a new tool to answer that question. So, but I think one of the points here was that the sum over all of the complicated three-manifold topologies seems to be imposing crossing. And so if you could do the sum over all of the topologies and find that it converged, that would somehow suggest that the theory does exist. And if it doesn't converge, that's the case where there was nothing. Maybe that's not surprising.
Yeah. All right. No more? All right, let's thank Daniel again.